I'm urging the Federal Communications Commission to do everything they can to protect net neutrality for everyone.
But even with the president behind it, net neutrality is still clinging for life. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After all these years, Hoover's FBI can still shock. Consider this newly unredacted letter from the agency to Martin Luther King.
You will find yourself and in all your dirt, filth, evil, and moronic talk exposed on the record for all time.
Also on the show, just in case a massive solar flare wipes out all of our electronics, there's a collection of old-time texts to see us through.
How to build steam engines, how to build sailing ships, how to be a lumberjack, how to plow a field with a mule instead of a tractor.
Solar-powered podcast, anyone?
Stay tuned.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We thought it was dead. Network neutrality, the principle that all internet traffic should be treated equally by broadband providers. Net neutrality has wide support, but also rabid opponents in telecoms and other ISPs who have the money and influence to kill policies dead, dead, dead. But then, on Monday, net neutrality was resuscitated by an unlikely paramedic.
That's why I'm laying out a plan to keep the internet free and open. And that's why I'm urging the Federal Communications Commission to do everything they can to protect net neutrality for everyone.
That's right. For his post-midterm policy debut, lame duck President Barack Obama chose to throw his weight not behind the Mideast peace process, not energy independence, not immigration reform, but net neutrality. In a post on the social publishing platform Medium, Obama laid out four, quote, bright line rules for the FCC to adopt to regulate ISPs. They include no blocking of websites, no intentional slowing down of content, increased transparency prior to that so-called last mile when the ISP connects to your home, and no paid prioritization of certain websites over others. That means nobody could pay or be shaken down by ISPs for tolls to get their traffic in a privileged fast lane. But Obama's boldest proposal was this.
To put these protections in place, I'm asking the FCC to reclassify internet service under Title II of a law known as the Telecommunications Act.
That request was the defibrillator. In 2010, the FCC tried to regulate broadband under Title I of the Telecommunications Act, but was rebuffed by a federal court. It was a matter of right church, wrong pew. As New York Times reporter Edward Wyatt explains it, the U.S. Circuit Court in D.C. objected not because the FCC has no statutory authority, but because the agency was pinning that authority on the wrong provision of the statute.
Under the old approach, which started in 2010, the FCC said that it had the authority to enforce no blocking and non-discrimination requirements on internet service providers. The same things that Obama said that he wants to do. But the court said you're treating these broadband providers as a public utility, as common carriers, much like phone companies. That oversteps what authority you have, and you can't do it that way. They didn't say that you can't do it. They just said you can't do it the way you did it.
Now, as I understand it, Ed, the court said to the FCC, to get what you want, you can achieve it in one of two ways. Number one, you can have authority under Title I. It's complicated, but you can do it. Or you can reclassify broadband altogether as a common carrier, like a public utility, and do it that way. But the chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, hasn't exactly signaled that he's going to embrace either of those paths, has he?
No, he hasn't. Tom Wheeler was trying to navigate a path between those, come up with a sort of hybrid approach that would allow him to reclassify part of the broadband infrastructure and not reclassify part of it. It's a split-the-baby approach that really both sides hated.
After his midterm defeat, the president decided to have one of his signature policies, net neutrality. And at least nominally, he doesn't have to battle the Congress to be successful, right? Because this is between the FCC and the Circuit Court in D.C., no?
Right. Congress doesn't have to approve, but they have oversight of the FCC, and so Congress can call Tom Wheeler up to Capitol Hill many times over the next 2 years, questioning every action that he takes and doesn't take.
Even if Congress isn't a party to the next step or two, the rumblings there are already suggesting that net neutrality will be the next Obamacare, the big fat target of not only the GOP, but of the Tea Party faction. What's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen is in a few months, the FCC is going to come out with a proposal deciding one way or the other whether to classify broadband as a utility. It will be voted on by the FCC. It will be a 3-2 vote, 3 Democrats for and 2 Republicans against, and it will be adopted. And either one of the companies or one of the public interest groups will wait a year or so, challenge it, and then it will be taken into court.
I asked you if this was going to be the Obamacare of the next Congress. I wonder if it's actually set up to be the Roe v. Wade, the never-ending battle between ideological opposites.
Well, it could be, except in this instance, ideological opposites in one circumstance are on the same side. The Republicans have cited the Supreme Court case that upheld the ability of the FCC to say broadband is not a utility. Writing a dissent in that decision was Justice Scalia, who said, "You guys are crazy. Obviously, broadband is a utility." So we have this unusual circumstance where if this goes to the Supreme Court, you know, in Justice Scalia, you have someone who thinks the same way that President Obama does about broadband is a utility.
Scalia and Obama on the same page. Ed, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Edward Wyatt covers net neutrality and the Federal Communications Commission for the New York Times.
Coming up, a new news outlet fixes its eye on criminal justice and some outrageous anecdotes on why we need it.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This weekend marks the official launch of The Marshall Project, a, quote, not-for-profit, nonpartisan news organization dedicated to covering America's criminal justice system. That's the way things are going, right? Increasingly, in-depth public service journalism has to be paid for, at least initially, by a few or even one deep-pocket donor. The poster child for this kind of news outlet is ProPublica. The philanthropic Sandler family launched it and bought big-time credibility when it hired former Wall Street Journal managing editor Paul Steiger to run it. For the Marshall Project, the pockets belong to former Journal reporter turned hedge fund manager Neil Barsky, and that blue chip cred belongs to former New York Times executive editor Bill Keller. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
So give me your three big reasons for jumping on the Marshall Project.
It's what the Pentagon refers to as a target-rich environment. I mean, you have not just the police, the courts, and the prisons, but you have immigration, you have drug policy, you have juveniles. Reason number two is the system is appallingly screwed up. And a third reason, there actually is some potential for progress on criminal justice, partly because there's a bit of an overlap between left and right on at least some issues of criminal justice, and partly because you have a generation that's grown up without the high crime rate that gave us a policy based on fear.
So you're saying that this is not, strictly speaking, a partisan issue. Where are those areas of overlap?
There's a lot of agreement between right and left on reducing sentencing for low-level drug offenders, for example, nonviolent offenders. There is sentencing legislation that's co-sponsored by Cory Booker and Rand Paul, two people who probably don't agree on very much of anything. And I don't want to pretend that left and right are lying down like the lion and the lamb. But there is common ground in the belief that we incarcerate way too many people, keep them too long, put them in prison too young, and we do way too little to help them reenter society when they're done.
So what's Neil Barsky's interest in this?
He comes from a civil rights family. His parents were members of the Congress of Racial Equality. And along with being a journalist, documentary filmmaker, and importantly for our purposes, a successful hedge fund operator, he's got a long history of philanthropy.
Was there like a book that changed his life?
There were two, actually. Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, which talks about the mass incarceration as the latest iteration of slavery and Jim Crow. And The Devil in the Grove, Gilbert King's account of a 1940s rape case in Florida in which a number of young black men were wrongfully convicted of the rape of a white woman.
Why would that have such an impact on Barsky now?
Well, there's an interesting kind of afterword. King interviewed a number of people who lived through that Jim Crow era and were sort of aware of the lynchings, the Ku Klux Klan behavior, the corruption of the sheriff's office. They all sort of knew that, but they sort of didn't want to know that. There was a kind of willful ignorance. And I think Neil's epiphany was that, you know, this is where journalism can actually confront people with problems that they would prefer not to see.
So tell me what your lens will be trained on, at least in the beginning. What are your initial targets?
Just by the nature of the beast, a lot of what we write is going to be about things that are working badly. The first project that we're publishing with the new website has to do with a quirk in the law that means people who are condemned are cut off from their last avenue of appeal.
That's the piece that's coming out this weekend in the Washington Post. This is a 1996 law that's supposed to give you a speedy trial, but instead it ends up depriving people of the opportunity to get real justice.
That's exactly right. And it's two parts. They're complicated pieces. I mean, there were two things that made us settle on this particular project as our launch. One of them was we wanted to send a message that we will do complicated stories. We think people will read complicated pieces if they're well done. And the other is, you know, it's very easy to generate sympathy for people who are innocent. But the real test of a democratic criminal justice system is how it treats the guilty or the people who may well be guilty.
You've been very clear that this is not an advocacy group, but you do want to spark a reaction, or to be more specific, action, don't you?
Absolutely. We want to spark a sense of indignation and sense of urgency.
You don't think there's enough of that?
On this issue, no. I mean, what really drives me nuts is the whole vicious cycle of it. Writ large, the criminal justice system is this institution that sucks up mostly black and Hispanic, mostly young men from their neighborhoods, puts them in a place where they learn no skills except maybe some survival skills, and then dumps them back in those communities. Leaving aside whether it's humane, it's just not good for public safety. It's stupid.
What about the timing of the Marshall Project? We have a 2016 presidential campaign coming up. Do you want in on that?
Yeah, Neil Barsky has said from the outset that when he's sort of asked what would you regard as a success, number one on his list is that in 2016, candidates who are routinely expected to have a position on Iran's nuclear weapons and immigration and taxes should be expected to have a position on criminal justice. It should be a natural thing that it comes up in the presidential debates.
Well, Bill, thank you very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Bill Keller is the editor of a new journalism nonprofit that debuts this weekend devoted to the coverage of criminal justice called The Marshall Project.
The attempts by late FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to discredit Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were an ugly and well-documented chapter in American history. The FBI wiretapped and hounded King and tried to peddle sordid details of his sex life to the press. Perhaps the most monstrous example was the so-called suicide letter, the typewritten blackmail note, till now available in heavily redacted form, is a study in blackmail wrapped in righteous indignation, threatening to expose King's sexual activities to the world unless he did the, quote, one thing left to escape shame. That thing is widely interpreted to mean suicide. Now Yale professor Beverly Gage has discovered a previously unseen redaction-free version of the letter. In this week's New York Times Magazine, she analyzes the elaborate dirty trick and wonders aloud how the contemporary media would have dealt with the dirt itself. In her article, Gage featured some of the most hate-filled previously redacted sections of the letter.
No person can overcome facts, not even a fraud like yourself. Lend your sexually psychotic ear to the enclosure. You will find yourself and in all your dirt, filth, evil, and moronic talk exposed on the record for all time.
So he sounds upset.
A little bit. The letter was sent by the FBI to King as an anonymous note, and it was accompanied by an audio tape that has not been released that was based on bugs that had been placed in King's hotel rooms while he was traveling, really as a threat of exposure.
Who actually wrote it?
The letter seems to have been written by a man named William Sullivan, who was one of Hoover's deputies. What's less clear is exactly what role Hoover himself played in all of this. This letter is, in fact, in Hoover's official and confidential files that he kept in his own office, but we don't have anything with Hoover's signature on it. He didn't sign off saying, "Terrific, send the tapes to King, send that letter to King."
Let's go back a bit to when and why the FBI got onto King in the first place. Where did this all begin?
The FBI had been following civil rights activists of various sorts, even as early as the 1920s. Black activists, people on the left. They hadn't actually been paying a lot of attention to King himself until about 1961, when they learned that one of his very close white advisors, a man named Stanley Levison, had actually been a pretty important figure in the Communist Party in the 1950s. They found out about Levison's growing relationship with King, and they found that in the Cold War context very alarming.
So civil rights troublemaker and a fairly high-level commie, just the sort of thing to get the attention of J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. The FBI had this theory that Stanley Levison might have broken with the Communist Party in order to then cozy up to Martin Luther King deliberately and act as a Soviet spy. So they had a sort of elaborate theory about all of this, not based on a lot of evidence, but that became the sort of national security logic for wiretapping Stanley Levison. And in turn, that became a kind of cascading series of invasions of privacy, which by 1963, they had begun to bug and wiretap King himself.
And for his part, Dr. King took on the FBI and questioned its tactics and its seriousness about enforcing federal law in the Deep South.
That's right. King saw the FBI as being sort of in collusion with Southern law enforcement, not protecting civil rights workers. And he had come out and said this publicly, which was the very thing that J. Edgar Hoover hated most in the world. And that was going to bring his attention to you more than just about anything that you could do. And so by November 18th, 1964, Hoover held a very long press conference, and one of the things that he said at that press conference was that King was, quote, the most notorious liar in the country.
That was the public attack on King. In the meantime, the FBI was using the fruits of its wiretapping campaign to try to leak material to the press about Dr. King's, let's just say, libertine behavior. And the press, this was the 60s, not 2014, said, no.
No one would bite. There was a different kind of culture around exposing the sexual private lives of public figures. John Kennedy's extramarital affairs are now very famous to us, but they were largely unknown at the time, though they were an open secret in Washington. I think, particularly in King's case, there was a sense that this wasn't just about exposing, say, the hypocrisy of someone who is supposed to be a moral leader but in fact is not being faithful to his wife, I think many reporters understood that this was an attempt to take down really an entire movement and to remove King as an influential political figure and resisted it for that reason. And then I think finally, reporters in the 1960s were probably quite afraid of the FBI. The FBI was very well known to take punitive action against reporters who printed things that the FBI did not like. You would certainly be cut out of the sort of FBI press release favored reporter circle, but you, in fact, might yourself become an FBI target. And so the combination of these things, I think, led to a much more cautious press in that moment and one that didn't move forward with these stories.
You know, I'm wondering about the convergence of this sort of zealotry with the technical capabilities that the intelligence apparatus now has to scoop all this information up, not just about a civil rights leader, but you and me. They're listening to all of us, are they not?
There seems to be a real consensus in Washington and elsewhere that what happened to Martin Luther King and what the FBI was doing to Martin Luther King was a bad thing. The current FBI director actually says that he keeps a copy of the wiretap request to wiretap Martin Luther King on his desk as a reminder about what internal overconfidence or sort of zealotry can in fact lead to. That said, I think there are a couple of cautionary tales to come out of this. And the first one is that if intelligence agencies have a lot of detailed information about people's personal lives, that there's a temptation to use it to carry out some sort of political or personal vendetta, as we saw happen in Martin Luther King's case. And I think it's also a useful reminder that often, though we're having these very passionate debates, we just don't know what's going on.
Beverly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Beverly Gage is a professor of American history at Yale University and the author of What an Uncensored Letter to MLK Reveals in Sunday's New York Times Magazine.
On the campus at Berkeley, there was beginning a phase of this youth revolt that was to be heard around the world.
The political tumult of the 1960s, when the remnants of the Red Scare collided with civil rights and Vietnam protests and the student free speech movement, had its epicenter on the campus of the University of California at Berkeley.
And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Movement leaders such as 21-year-old Mario Savio, speaking here on the Berkeley campus in 1964, lit a fire under the FBI that raged for years. Student journalist Seth Rosenfeld got on the story and spent decades investigating FBI misconduct in pursuing the student movement. We spoke to Rosenfeld in 2012 when he published Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. It documents the secret relationships between the FBI and Ronald Reagan, handpicked journalists, and the radical movement itself. The book is based on some 300,000 FBI records obtained through five separate Freedom of Information Act requests, which the FBI spent more than $1 million trying to fight. Among the revelations therein, Ronald Reagan's long career as an FBI informant and collaborator, starting back in the late 40s when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Reagan continued as an informant through the 1950s. J. Edgar Hoover repaid the favor by giving Reagan personal and political help.
Such as intervention in family matters.
Yes. In 1959, Ronald Reagan and his former wife, Jane Wyman, became concerned about their eldest daughter, Maureen Reagan. She was 19 years old, and she had moved to Washington, D.C. And they had heard that she was living with an older married policeman. Instead of simply calling up their daughter and asking her what was going on, Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman turned to the FBI. One FBI agent posed as an insurance salesman and interviewed neighbors of Maureen Reagan. Another interviewed the cleaning lady. J. Edgar Hoover personally authorized an FBI investigation into the romantic life of Maureen Reagan.
You argue in the book that this relationship between Ronald Reagan and J. Edgar Hoover was the beginning of what turned out to be a historic trajectory.
I think the FBI's relationship with Ronald Reagan, starting in Hollywood and continuing through the 50s and 60s, helps explain Ronald Reagan's political evolution from being a liberal in Hollywood to becoming a staunch conservative and going on to become the president who would face down the Soviet Union. When Ronald Reagan was elected governor in 1966, J. Edgar Hoover and other FBI officials thought they finally had an ally in the governor's mansion. A few weeks after Reagan took office, he phoned the FBI and requested a confidential briefing, not only about student activists, but also about university president Clark Kerr and liberal members of the Board of Regents. Hoover personally authorized this briefing. 2 weeks later, Clark Kerr was fired as president of the University of California. In the months and years following, J. Edgar Hoover continued to give Ronald Reagan confidential reports about student activists and professors. Reagan used this information to quash student protests and other First Amendment activity at the University of California.
At the same time, the FBI was using friendly press to undermine its perceived enemies.
One of the most prominent reporters in San Francisco was a man named Ed Montgomery. In 1951, Montgomery won the Pulitzer Prize for exposing corruption involving underworld figures and officials of the Bureau of Internal Revenue, as the IRS was then known. All along, he had a secret relationship with the FBI. Montgomery was a larger-than-life character. He had dark, swept-back hair, horn-rimmed eyeglasses. He wore a bulky hearing aid that he would, according to legend, sometimes lower through a heating duct so he could eavesdrop on conversations in other rooms. In the 60s, when student protests erupted at UC Berkeley, the FBI gave Montgomery information containing allegations that members of the free speech movement had connections to the Communist Party. This information was greatly distorted because the FBI had already investigated the free speech movement and knew that there was a tiny percentage of students who had some connection to the Communist Party or the Socialist Party. In fact, the free speech movement included students of all political persuasions, including young Republicans and young Democrats. But the FBI provided these allegations to Montgomery, and he ran a front-page series in the San Francisco Examiner, picked up widely around the country. In the following years, J. Edgar Hoover ordered other information leaked to Ed Montgomery to discredit the anti-war movement or to tarnish student activists or liberal professors who were involved in the anti-war movement.
And it wasn't just Ed Montgomery. There was a number of friendly journalists who Hoover could count on to embellish the communist threat narrative.
He had actually created a program called the Mass Media Program. And there were scores of reporters around the country, reporters, broadcasters, editors, who the FBI trusted to confidentially receive information and to report it without revealing the FBI's role in trying to influence public opinion. All this comes out in the FBI records that were released to me under the Freedom of Information Act.
As both a beneficiary of FOIA and its three decades long victim, what's your take on the state of the Freedom of Information Act in 2012?
During the course of my research, I had the opportunity to study FBI records that had been released under six presidential administrations. I can say that while Democratic administrations are somewhat friendlier to the Freedom of Information Act than Republican administrations, there's an enormous problem within the federal government of overclassifying documents. I was encouraged when President Obama, as one of his first acts in office, issued a strong statement in support of the Freedom of Information Act. But I soon came to realize that that memo apparently never reached the Justice Department. I want to note that today's FBI is very different than J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. There's much more public accountability. There's much more congressional oversight. Nonetheless, I would say the FBI is withholding as much information under the Freedom of Information Act today as it did under the administrations of George Bush.
Well, Seth, congratulations on the book. Now, I strongly advise you to go outside. Just, live a little.
Thank you so much.
Seth Rosenfeld is the author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power.
Coming up, helpful hints for surviving the apocalypse.
This is On the Media.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A ways back, there was the Carrington event, which may sound like a Robert Ludlum thriller, but in fact was an 1859 solar storm that created such an electromagnetic disturbance that telegraph service went haywire globally. Now, that was 155 years ago, when telegraph, electrical technology-wise, was pretty much the whole ball of wax. Now our infrastructure, our economies, our way of life is entirely tethered to electronic technology. So what if there were a sequel to 1859? Rocky Rollins is haunted by that thought. The IT specialist has built the website SurvivorLibrary.com as a store of knowledge in case the next solar flare pulses us back to the pre-electronic age. Rocky, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Splendid, thank you. How and when did you start thinking about the Carrington event?
Well, actually, there's been several since 1859. There was one in 1989 that actually melted a good number of the power transformers in New Jersey, which took like 6 months to replace. There was one in 2012 that was almost as large as the Carrington event. Fortunately, it missed us. If it had hit us, we'd be living in the 1800s right now. What got me started in this was when I used to work for the government, and we had to deal with making sure that computers were tempest-hardened so that they would survive an EMP effect in case there was a nuclear exchange in a war.
EMP, that's electromagnetic pulse.
Exactly. A nuclear weapon explosion creates an electromagnetic pulse, which generates current, high amperage current, in any kind of electrical circuit it hits, like computers. In 2001, Congress set up a committee to see whether it was something we needed to worry about or do something about, primarily concerned with what would happen if a rogue nation like North Korea or Iran got hold of a nuclear weapon and used it to launch an EMP attack on the United States by detonating a high-altitude nuclear weapon. Then they also began to understand that there was the potential of a solar-caused EMP.
Now, you can sort of negotiate with North Korea. You can't negotiate with the sun.
Exactly.
What did Congress, in its wisdom, decide to do about that kind of, you know, all life on Earth ends scenario?
Up till now, they've done nothing. The UK is taking it seriously enough that they built an alternate navigation system for their merchant fleets in case the GPS satellites are damaged or destroyed, so that their ships will be able to navigate, which ours won't be.
If you were the president or the Pentagon or the Department of Homeland Security, what would you do to protect us against electromagnetic pulses?
Spend about $3 billion and harden the power grid. We don't keep backup transformers. They come from Europe and they take a year to make. Simply by shielding the transformers on our power grid, it would ensure that even if everything else went down, the power grid would stay up. And if the power grid stays up, that's 90% of the battle right there. Several congressmen and senators have put forward bills to protect the grid. So far, it's never even made it to a vote or a committee.
So tell me about the Survivor Library. What's in it?
Mostly books that range from the early 1800s through the early 1900s. Essentially, it's a codex of knowledge and skills and technology as it existed before the widespread use of electronics. pretty much everything you would need to know to rebuild an 1800s, early 1900s industrial and technological infrastructure.
So you navigate not by GPS, but by sextant and dead reckoning.
Right.
And what else is in there?
Medical books, how to build steam engines, how to operate steam locomotives, how to build sailing ships, how to build a lumber mill using water power, how to be a lumberjack, how to plow a field with a mule instead of a tractor, how to build simple airplanes.
You got livestock sheep, livestock swine, medical anesthesia, pottery, poultry, printing, embalming. What's the coolest category in this archive?
It's hard to say. I mean, every time I come across a new one, that one becomes the most fascinating for a while. Like right now, I'm just putting a meteorology group up there, which is everything you need to know to do weather predictions and weather forecasting without radars and satellites.
There's a category for morality.
Exactly.
The Elements of Moral Science, 1865, The Crisis in Morals, 1891, mm-hmm. and Principles of Religion and Morality from 1807. This is really one-stop shopping for building a society.
I've read a lot of these books, or at least looked through them in great depth. I do not want to live in the 1800s. Heaven forbid. I know too much from reading these books what living in the 1800s was like. It was a harsh and brutal period of time compared to today. But if an EMP event occurs, living in the 1800s and early 1900s is a lot better than reverting to the 1400s or 1500s, which is what we would have for a while.
One last thing, Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say there's a solar storm, electromagnetic pulses that fry everything, and society needs answers. We rush to our computers. We type in survivorlibrary.com, but, dude, the network is down.
We've got, at this point, it looks like about 7,000 people downloading these books just off of my site. Most of the people downloading these things are doing what we're all doing. We're dumping copies of them on DVDs or CDs or small portable hard drives, taking those and a spare laptop and shoving them in a Faraday cage in a closet someplace just in case. And even if an EMP event occurred, probably some of the computers would survive. Then you've got a community project where people start bringing these books up, dumping them to printers, binding them, putting covers on them, labeling them, putting them on shelves, and start building a physical library that everybody in the community can use.
Build some furniture, embalm the dead, and do it all morally. Rocky, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rocky Rollins works in IT support for an online retailer. He is the archivist and creator of SurvivorLibrary.com.
That's a plan if humanity is to have a future. But what if we know for certain to the day when it all ends? That's the central question of novelist Ben Winter's trilogy, The Last Policeman. All the action takes place in the six final months left before the arrival of a fatal asteroid. Inspiring, depending on one's disposition, suicide, criminality, and frolicking on beaches. But the central character in Winter's trilogy is a policeman who just wants to do his job. Meanwhile, there's a bidding war over which news show gets exclusive dibs on the final announcement. In Winter's book, CBS newsman Scott Pelley wins the ultimate, and I do mean ultimate, get. The scientist with the terminal calculation. Ben Winters, would you read that section?
Sure. Pelley leans forward, all empathy, asks the magically stupid question that all the world needed to hear. So then, Doctor, what are our options? Dr. Leo Tolkien trembling, almost laughing. Options? There are no options. And then Tolkien just keeps talking, babbling really, about how sorry he is on behalf of the world's astronomical community, how they had studied every realistic scenario, but this never could have been imagined. An object with such a near perihelion, with such an epically long elliptical period, such a staggeringly large object. The odds of such an object's existence so vanishingly low. And Scott Pelley is staring at him, and all over the world, people are sinking into grief or hysteria. Because all at once, there was no more ambiguity, no more doubt. Odds of impact 100%. October 3rd, no options. Many people remained glued to their televisions after the program ended, watching pundits and professors of astronomy and political figures stammering and weeping. Many people ran to the phones to try to reach loved ones, though all the circuits were jammed and would remain that way for the week that followed. Other people went out into the streets, bitter January weather notwithstanding, to commiserate with neighbors or strangers, or to engage in small acts of vandalism or petty mischief. I, personally, turned off the TV and went to work.
I was in my fourth week as the detective. I had an arson case I was working on.
It's busy.
That's obviously a turning point. From then on, more and more people start drifting away from life as they'd lived it, and they cease going through the motions. But not this guy. What is the deal with Hank Pallas?
Well, Hank is a dedicated lawman. I mean, this is all he ever wanted to do. Since he was a little kid, he really wanted to be a cop, and he believes in justice and law enforcement. The idea that the world is coming to an end is obviously upsetting, but for him, he doesn't understand why that means he shouldn't do the job that he was sort of put here to do. A couple times over the course of the trilogy, he expresses this to people. Well, why shouldn't we all just keep on doing what we're supposed to be doing? The asteroid isn't here yet. The thing that makes most sense is for everyone to stay the course because then it can't affect us until it actually gets here.
He's already doing the main thing on his bucket list. And if everybody in life were doing what they wanted to do, there would be no unraveling.
Which I think Hank would admit. Most people aren't fortunate enough to be doing something in life that they can feel dedicated to. If your job is, you know, sweeping up somewhere, then it's probably harder to justify continuing doing it when the world is unraveling around you.
You depict the technological unraveling, how the global communications that tied everybody together begin to fray.
You know, that's interesting. And the passage that you asked me to read there, that was my major media event. The last time on Earth, there's one of these things where it's going to be on TV, everybody's going to be watching it, which in real life is happening less and less frequently, that there is one big thing that everybody cares about. But at the beginning of the first book, the world is still close enough to the world that we inhabit that I could, I think, realistically do a scene like that where everyone's been watching the asteroid get closer on the internet or in TV specials. When it first shows up, it's in that zany news category, you know, where it shows up on your homepage, a news of the weird kind of thing. But then it gets closer and closer. I do this mainstream media event pretty early on. The internet starts to get spotty. And then eventually it blinks out. When people start to drift off and go into their bucket list adventures and disappear into their bunkers, those kinds of massive infrastructural systems start to fall apart. And I show that with the water. I show it with electricity. And there's a scene about halfway through the second book where my protagonist, he's on a college campus, which is turned into this utopian anarchic society. And he's sitting next to this kid and he notices that the kid has got his iPhone out. Just keeps taking it out and running his thumb over it over and over and over again, as if by some magic it's going to turn on.
We would continue to feel them like the famous amputated limbs, you know?
I think that's totally true, Brooke. It's like it's a part of us.
And then when you get to the third book, things have really come apart. There is a complete lack of information, and as always happens in the real world, conspiracy theories rush in to fill the gap. Hank's sister is fully committed to belief in a conspiracy that there is a way to blow up the asteroid, a way to avert disaster.
They take basically opposite points of view toward the coming apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
Pallas, he just wants to keep doing his job. He trusts the scientists. He trusts the government. He trusts the mainstream media. He believes that this is happening. And therefore, there's nothing to be done about it. It's just a matter of waiting. Nico, on the other hand, becomes involved in this sort of shadowy and complicated conspiracy to either prove the asteroid isn't real or to stop the asteroid. Part of that for me was another representation of this self-selected media consumption age that we're in, where it's very easy to find an infinite amount of confirmation of your feeling or belief and to more or less avoid or condemn anything that would be contrary to your belief.
It isn't just that she's naive. She's chosen a way to face the end of the world that makes her feel that her last moments on Earth matter. And you could certainly argue that Hank's don't. His first homicide involves what looks like a suicide. And given that so many people are committing suicide and they only have 6 months left anyway, what is the difference?
It doesn't matter if the world is coming to an end. It doesn't matter what the context is. This is a murder victim and he deserves the same justice under the law that everybody does. If I believe in the rule of law, then I believe in it all the time, forever.
Right. He's a moral absolutist, and his sister is in her way too. And in the midst of these siblings finding their way to live their lives, you have the echoes of the past. Hank and a colleague at a police precinct in Ohio.
Yeah. So they're at this police station and they find this old radio device, and Hank, it starts broadcasting a message. Here, I'll read about it too. I'm remembering the same console at Concord PD. It was rendered obsolete by the digital laptop systems that were installed a couple years before I took the oath. And it sat there in the corner, black and shiny and immovable, a monument to traditional police work. The message coming out of the rotary radio command says, "First aid centers have been established in the following communities. First aid centers have been established in the following communities." And then the lady starts to list them. Good old-fashioned Norman Rockwell town names. Conesville, Zanesville, Davola. It is creating this low, wistful feeling in my heart, the woman's voice, the drone of the machine, and I think it may simply be that I miss information. For most of my life, the world was awash with news, with reports of things happening. And then, in the last year, they blipped off the radar, one by one. The Concord Monitor and the New York Times, and then television, the whole concept of television, and the internet with its ceaseless froth and churn, all of it just gone.
Over the course of the three books, the background noise gets quieter and quieter and quieter up to the penultimate moment. And he's in a place he never would have imagined he would be, with people he never would imagined he would ever know, doing what he never would imagine he would ever do. When you think about the quiet that inhabits the world at that time, I mean, there's an ineffable sadness, but is there also a sense of, I don't know, completion somehow?
Well, to be honest, as I was writing it, there was something a little appealing about saying, what must it feel like to again have that kind of quiet? I guess it's a little bit of a shame that it took an approaching asteroid to achieve that. But as you say, there's something attractive about it, a peace. You almost mourn for it.
But you'd never give up the internet.
Well, you know, you got to check your email.
Why did you write this book?
Well, if I'm totally honest, the initial impulse was, what is a really, really interesting way of telling a detective story, right? Like, what if there is this massive object coming? It's going to destroy civilization, but I've got a guy who's still trying to solve a crime. I sort of said, aha. But I think very quickly, Brooke, as I was writing it, what I found ultimately was a story about how all of us choose to order our lives, given the fact that there's some kind of asteroid coming for all of us. The thing about Hank is that he can't stop working. And at the beginning of the books, he comes off as heroic for that reason. You know, he's the man who cares when nobody else does, which is a pretty old trope in crime writing. And I think I've given it something of a new spin. He cares when nobody else does, but there's a really good reason that other people don't care. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the last book, his dedication, his sense of needing to keep working no matter what, it starts to feel less heroic and a little bit more like madness.
Like his sister.
Yeah, like you just have to believe in something. You have to.
But at the end, he has to give it up. He runs out the string.
Yeah, he runs out the string. That's right.
Now, is your trilogy called The Last Policeman? Do you have an overall name, like Song of Fire and Ice?
No, I wish. That would be catchy. No, it's just called The Last Policeman Trilogy.
Okay.
You know what? I take it back. It's called The Song of Fire and Ice. That's I like that.
That's good. It was a great book, Ben. Thank you so much.
Oh, man, thank you so much. I was so happy to get your guys' email.
Ben Winters is the author of The Last Policeman Trilogy, which received an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America, as well as a Philip K. Dick Award for Distinguished Science Fiction. Winters' mortal instrument was an asteroid, but it could have just as easily been a comet. That sound is from the 1998 movie Deep Impact, where a comet flattens cities and drowns most of the human race. In the 1984 movie Night of the Comet, a comet chooses among us, either for death or zombification.
They said be careful on the street, because some people were exposed to the comet a little bit. What happened to Doris is happening to them, only slower.
Historically, across the globe, comets were curses, so much so that one prompted the Emperor Nero to murder all of his potential successors, though he might have done that anyway. In Switzerland, Halley's Comet was blamed for earthquakes, illnesses, and the births of two-headed beasts. In England, it was blamed for the Black Death. And the Christian Church cited scripture to proclaim comets balls of fire flung from the right hand of an angry God to warn the groveling dwellers of earth. But humankind no longer shudders. Instead, it saddles up. This week, Comet 67P met the European Space Agency's Philae space probe. It landed, bounced, settled in the shade, and may risk a jump into sunlight so it can power up. And the comet, well, the comet sings. That's the sound magnified 10,000 times of oscillations in 67P's magnetic field. With humanity so bloodied with self-inflicted wounds, this landing is an absolute good. It's a wondrous thing to meet one's old demons and hear them sing. Maybe it will prime us to meet our newer demons sooner than later.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovich, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.